Have you ever been stuck in the passenger seat of a car and you suddenly realize you are essentially trying to steer the whole vehicle from the back seat?
Oh, absolutely. It's terrifying.
Right, like you're gripping the door handle until your knuckles turn totally white. You're, pumping an imaginary brake pedal on the floorboard.
Leaning your whole body into the turns.
Yes, leaning into the turns. You do all of this like secretly hoping your physical tension will somehow magically force the actual driver to change course.
Which is, I mean, it's the ultimate illusion of control.
Totally. It's exhausting. It's incredibly stressful. And, well, obviously, it doesn't work at all.
No, it doesn't, because you're expending these massive amounts of emotional and physical energy trying to manipulate an outcome. But the reality is, your hands aren't even on the wheel. The car is going where the driver takes it.
And that deeply relatable, highly frustrating scenario is exactly how so many couples operate in their day-to-day marriages.
Yeah, they really do.
They're sitting in the passenger seat of the relationship, fruitlessly trying to, steer their partner's behavior. So today we are doing a deep dive into the insights from a book called Eight Lessons for a Happier Marriage by Dr. William Glasser and Carlene Glasser.
It's such a foundational read.
It really is. And our mission for this deep dive is to extract the core psychological shifts the authors present, these exact eight lessons, and give you, the listener, a practical roadmap for actually incorporating them into your life.
Because if you don't, I mean, without these tools, you risk sliding right down what the authors describe as the slippery slope of divorce.
And the stakes of that slippery slope are undeniably high. But the potential for recovery is actually quite astonishing when you look at the data, right?
It really is. There's this striking detail in the foreword of the book, which was provided by Dr. John Carlson. He cites research showing that 3 out of 4 divorcing couples who decide to halt the proceedings,
Wait, 3 out of 4?
75%, 3 out of 4 who halt proceedings and stay together report being satisfied in their relationship 5 years later.
That is wild.
Right. That means a massive majority of the time, the damage in a marriage isn't terminal. It's not that the relationship is inherently broken. It's just, being managed poorly.
That is a staggering statistic. It really shifts the perspective away from this idea of, well, we're just completely incompatible to, hey, we simply lack the right set of tools.
Exactly. It gives a lot of hope. And actually, Bruce Clemens, who is a divorce lawyer with like 30 years of experience, he noted something fascinating in the preface that totally backs this up.
What did he say?
Well, over his career, he represented incredibly wealthy individuals, right?
Yeah.
And he observed that they frequently divorced over toxic relationship patterns that all their money literally couldn't fix.
Oh, wow. So you can't just buy your way out of a bad dynamic.
Right. The root problems were almost never financial or logistical. They were deeply behavioral. They were patterns of interaction that, frankly, the concepts in this book could have fundamentally cured.
So, I mean, where do these toxic behavioral patterns actually start? Because to build a better dynamic, we have to understand the faulty foundation that destroys most marriages in the first place.
For sure. The authors argue that it usually begins right after the honeymoon phase ends.
The dreaded end of the honeymoon phase.
Exactly. That's when couples fall into the trap of something called external control. And they use a very vivid metaphor to describe this
The
phenomenon.
lemmings, right?
Yes, the lemmings. They describe human beings and relationships as a bunch of lemmings walking right off a gently sloping cliff.
Just blindly marching toward the edge together.
Just marching along. And the reason they are willingly walking off that cliff is that they are desperately trying to recreate the initial effortless high of infatuation.
Because infatuation is basically a drug.
It really is. Think about when a couple first gets together. Infatuation acts like a chemical buffer in the brain. You accept literally everything about the other person.
Like, oh, he leaves his socks everywhere? That's so endearing.
Exactly. Their flaws are cute. But eventually, inevitably, infatuation fades. And when it fades, reality sets in. That is the critical moment.
And when that effortless high is gone, couples instinctively turn to external control to get it back.
Right. Yes. Meaning they try to force the other person to change back into the idealized version they were infatuated with.
So this is that backseat driving we just talked about.
Exactly. We start thinking, well, if I just guilt them enough about working late, or, if I give them the silent treatment when they forget to take out the trash, they will eventually cave and act the way I want.
That is so toxic, but so common.
It is the core mechanism of external control. It's this belief that you can force, coerce, or manipulate your spouse into conforming to your desires.
which is just a fatal psychology for a relationship.
Yeah, totally fatal, because it strips the other person of their autonomy. It replaces a mutual partnership with, like, a dynamic of a warden and a prisoner.
Right. And it seems like if we accept that trying to control our partner is a guaranteed way to kill the marriage, the obvious next step is figuring out what drives our behavior in the first place.
Which brings us to lesson two.
Yes. The authors present an alternative framework called choice theory. And the fundamental axiom here is that from birth to death, all we do is behave, and every single behavior is chosen.
That's the crux of it.
But, I mean, I have to push back on this on behalf of anyone listening right now, because that goes against how we naturally experience the world.
It's a very difficult concept to swallow at first.
Yeah.
How does it clash with your experience specifically?
Well, okay, if my partner walks into the room and just criticizes me harshly out of nowhere, it physically feels like they made me angry.
Right, you get that visceral reaction.
Yeah. My heart rate spikes, my blood pressure goes up, I immediately feel defensive. Acknowledging choice theory would mean admitting I am actively choosing my anger in that moment.
And that feels wrong.
It feels impossible. When you are in the thick of a fight, choosing to be angry feels like a reflex, not a choice.
I get that. And that friction you're describing is the exact hurdle most couples face when trying to adopt this mindset. It's really important to separate the biological reality from the psychological response here.
Okay, break that down for me.
When you are criticized, your nervous system does react. That adrenaline spike is physiological. You aren't choosing that. But choice theory clarifies that what you do with that physical sensation, how you process that information and react to it, is entirely your choice.
So the initial sting isn't a choice, but the decision to yell back is.
Precisely. Your partner's criticism is simply information being introduced into your environment. You cannot control that they said it, but absolutely no one can control how you respond unless you choose to let them.
I mean, that's empowering, but also a little daunting.
It is, because you choose to argue back. You choose to harbor resentment for 3 days. You could just as easily choose to take a deep breath, walk away, or respond calmly.
It just doesn't feel like a choice because we're so used to it.
Exactly. We have practiced reacting defensively for our entire lives. It's a deeply worn groove in our brains. But fundamentally, we are driven from within, not from without.
Okay, so if it's not the outside world pushing our buttons, what is the actual engine inside of us? What is driving those choices?
According to the Glassers, the engine is made up of 5 basic needs. And these aren't just like passing preferences. They are genetically programmed drives.
And what are they?
They are survival, love and belonging, power, freedom, and fun.
Survival, love, power, freedom, fun. Got it.
Every single choice we make, from the clothes we wear to the arguments we pick, is a subconscious attempt to satisfy one or more of these 5 basic needs.
I can totally see how that creates a minefield in a marriage.
Uh-huh.
When two people come together, you don't just get 2 personalities, you get 2 distinct sets of drives constantly bumping into each other.
Oh, yeah. And understanding the mechanics of those drives explains why certain conflicts feel literally impossible to resolve.
Can you give an example of that?
Sure. Let's look at a concrete example. Imagine a couple where partner A has a very high need for power. And in this psychological context, power doesn't mean being a dictator.
Right. Not like an evil villain.
No, it means a deep need for achievement, to be heard, and to feel competent. But partner A has a relatively low need for love and belonging.
Okay, and partner B?
Partner B, on the other hand, has a massive need for love and belonging, but also a high need for freedom.
Oh man, that sounds like a recipe for disaster.
It really can be.
Because partner A wants to, like, dictate how the finances are managed to feel competent, while partner B wants the freedom to spend without being micromanaged, but also desperately wants to feel loved and connected in the process.
Exactly. And unless they both recognize these underlying basic drives, they won't realize they're actually fighting about their fundamental needs.
They'll just keep arguing about the credit card bill.
Yes. They will just constantly bicker over who is quote-unquote right about the spending. They'll be stuck in this perpetual power struggle, using external control nagging, criticizing, withdrawing, to try and force the other person to meet their specific needs.
Okay, so we have this profound realization that we only control ourselves and we're just trying to meet these basic needs. That brings us to lesson 3. How do we actually stop ourselves from using coercion in the heat of the moment?
It's hard.
Like, when my partner leaves their wet towel on the bed for the 5th time this week, my immediate instinct is to complain. How do I actually change that habit?
Well, it requires a conscious swapping of behaviors. The authors outline what they call the seven deadly habits of a relationship.
These are the default weapons of external control, right?
Exactly, they are. Criticizing, blaming, complaining, nagging, threatening, punishing, and bribing or rewarding to control.
Okay, most of those are pretty obvious relationship killers. Mm. Nagging and criticizing clearly push people away, but bribing or rewarding to control.
That one is super sneaky.
Yeah, that one sneaks under the radar. It feels like you're doing something nice.
It masks itself as kindness, but the mechanism underneath is still manipulation.
How so?
Well, if you say, I'll buy you that watch you wanted if you come to my family's house for the holidays without complaining.
Right.
You aren't fostering mutual desire or compromise there. You are engaging in transactional control. You're basically paying them to suppress their own needs.
Oh, wow. Yeah, when you put it like that, it's totally manipulative.
If you want a genuinely happier marriage, you must entirely replace those seven deadly habits with the seven caring habits.
And the caring habits are supporting, encouraging, listening, accepting, trusting, respecting, and negotiating differences.
A much better list.
It is a beautiful list.
Yeah.
But, I mean, making that swap when you are already deeply frustrated with your spouse is incredibly difficult. If they are still criticizing you, it feels really unfair to suddenly start supporting and accepting them.
It does feel unfair, which is why the authors introduce this amazing strategy of a giving negotiation.
I love this concept. A giving negotiation is kind of like changing the temperature of the thermostat in the house without telling anyone.
Yes, perfect analogy.
You just decide, completely on your own, to give a little for a while without expecting any immediate reciprocation. You simply choose to stop criticizing and start listening.
You don't announce it. You don't hold a big meeting about it.
Right. You don't demand they do it too. You just quietly make the environment warmer, and eventually the other person takes off their defensive winter coat because the room is no longer freezing.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. It changes the entire ecosystem of the relationship because usually negotiations in unhappy marriages are so rigid and conditional.
Like, I'll stop nagging when you stop leaving your clothes on the floor.
Exactly. That is a standoff. Neither person wants to be the first to drop their weapon. A giving negotiation is a unilateral move toward the caring habits.
You just have to let go of the idea that everything must be perfectly fair and balanced in the short term.
Right, in order to save the long-term health of the marriage.
Which flows perfectly into lesson four. The reason we get so defensive and rigid in the first place comes down to another major concept the authors explore, which they call the quality world.
This is one of the most illuminating ideas in the whole book.
I think so too. The quality world is basically this mental picture album we've been building since birth, right?
Yep. It contains highly specific, idealized images of what makes us feel good, important, and safe. We all have our own highly specific quality world.
And it's different for everyone.
Totally. It holds our ideal versions of people, beliefs, and experiences. And typically, the people we easily allow into our quality world are people who think, act, and value the exact same things we do.
It's like having an exclusive VIP lounge inside our brains.
Oh, I love that.
We only unclip the velvet rope for people who perfectly fit our specific dress code of behaviors and values.
Exactly.
But here is the mechanism that creates the fatal trap in marriages. Opposites often attract, especially early on when infatuation and sexual chemistry are super high.
Right, the lemmings again.
Exactly. So we invite someone into our VIP lounge who is actually fundamentally different from us. And the trap is, we assume that with enough of our love and guidance, we can force our partner to change their outfit to fit into our VIP lounge permanently.
That is the external control assumption operating at its most dangerous level.
We invite them in, and then we think, well, once we're married, he'll finally stop being so messy.
Or once we have kids, she'll stop being such a workaholic. We expect them to conform to the pictures in our quality world.
And when they don't change, because of course they're operating out of the pictures in their own quality world, we feel deeply betrayed.
We feel lied to. But the realization couples need to have is that you must get acquainted with your partner's quality world. Understand what is in their VIP lounge.
And accept that you cannot force them to remodel their brain to match yours.
Exactly. Okay, so let's synthesize where we are in the journey. A couple might be listening to this and thinking, all right, I understand we have clashing basic needs. I see that our quality worlds are different. I know I'm using the deadly habits, and I'm utterly miserable.
Right. How do they physically get unstuck?
Well, for lesson five, the authors provide a mechanical breakdown of human behavior that is incredibly practical. They call it total behavior, and they use the analogy of a four-wheel drive car.
I am obsessed with this analogy.
It's so good. It is vital for understanding how to actually execute these changes. So imagine you and your partner, each as your own four-wheel drive car traveling down a highway.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
The engine of your car represents those five basic needs we discussed. They provide the raw horsepower and the drive to move forward. But how you steer the car, how you actually navigate the road, is where the mechanism of total behavior becomes critical.
Right. So the car has four wheels. The two front wheels represent your acting and your thinking.
Yes.
And the two rear wheels represent your feeling and your physiology.
Now, consider what happens when a person is deeply unhappy in their marriage. They are sitting in the driver's seat of their car. They are feeling hopeless, resentful, and physically exhausted.
And they are trying to steer the car by yanking on the rear wheels.
Yes. They're focusing entirely on how miserable they feel and hoping that if they just focus on the sadness, their feelings will magically change course and take the car to a happier place.
But you cannot steer a vehicle with the rear wheel.
You literally can't. That explains why sitting on the couch just trying to feel less angry never works. You have no direct voluntary control over the rear wheels, your feelings, or your physiology.
You can't just command your heart to stop racing or command your brain to suddenly feel joy.
Exactly. You only have voluntary control over the front wheels, your conscious thinking, and your physical acting.
And that is the secret mechanism of total behavior. If you physically grab the steering wheel, which controls those front wheels of your thoughts and actions, and you steer them toward the caring habits, something amazing happens.
The rear wheels just follow.
Yes. The rear wheels of your feelings and physiology are attached to the chassis of the car. They have absolutely no choice but to follow where the front wheels lead.
So if you act lovingly, even when you don't feel like it initially, the positive feelings will eventually get dragged along for the ride.
Physiology follows action. You don't have to wait for the motivation or the feeling of happiness to arrive before you do something kind for your spouse. You do the kind thing, and the happiness follows.
Precisely. And this leads into lesson six, which is a very practical piece of advice.
Yeah.
If you need to get those front wheels moving in a positive direction, you have to consciously inject creativity and fun back into the dynamic.
Because fun is one of the five basic needs.
Exactly. Since the front wheels dictate the direction of the relationship, doing something lighthearted together is one of the most effective ways to steer out of a rut.
Go watch a comedian, take a cooking class, or just intentionally laugh together.
Right, because choice theory is fundamentally meant to be a lighthearted psychology. Fun directly satisfies one of our basic needs without requiring any external control at all.
And there is actual data backing up why that fun is so crucial. In successful relationships, there is a vital ratio that has to be maintained. For every one negative interaction, there need to be five positive responses. A 5-to-1 ratio.
That is a lot of positive reinforcement needed.
It is. There is a great cartoon mentioned in the book that perfectly illustrates the pain of getting this ratio wrong. A wife is complaining that her husband seems to care more about the family dog than he cares about her.
Ouch, but I mean, it happens.
And the brutal, funny reality of the mechanism is, well, the husband is probably getting a lot more positive responses from the dog.
The dog doesn't nag him when he walks in the door.
Exactly. The dog doesn't critique how he loaded the dishwasher. The dog is just thrilled to see him. We have to creatively engineer those positive interactions with our spouses so we become a source of joy, not a source of stress.
That makes total sense. And when you start driving your own car correctly, using your front wheels to choose caring habits and prioritize positive interactions, you build tremendous momentum.
Which brings us to lessons 7 and 8.
Right. What is beautiful about this process is that when a couple gets their own dynamic sorted out, that positive energy doesn't just stay between the two of them. It radiates outward and changes the entire ecosystem of the house.
The authors explicitly address this in Lesson 7 when it comes to children. They suggest that at your discretion, you should actually share what you are doing to improve your marriage with your kids.
Because children are incredibly perceptive barometers of the emotional weather in a home.
Oh, they absorb everything.
They feel the tension of external control, the subtle nagging, and the underlying bickering, even when parents think they are perfectly hiding it.
Which they never are.
Never. So when parents consciously shift away from those deadly habits and start practicing choice theory, it reduces the ambient family stress immensely.
And you don't have to give them like a psychological lecture either.
Yeah. No.
Just bringing them into the loop and saying, hey, mom and dad are trying to be better listeners and use kinder habits when we talk to each other. It sets an unbelievable example.
It models healthy conflict resolution and teaches them choice theory through action before they ever have to read a book about it.
But the ultimate radiation of this new positive energy happens in the most private, vulnerable space of the relationship, which is lesson 8, physical intimacy.
Yes. The authors argue that maintaining a vibrant sexual connection is the ultimate way to replace that temporary waning infatuation we discussed at the very beginning with deep, lasting love.
I want to spend a moment on this because they make a really bold claim here. They state that a very high percentage of the sexual experience actually takes place in the mind rather than just the body.
It's mostly mental.
So how does the concept of external control intersect with physical intimacy?
Well, to understand the mechanism here, think about what external control thrives on. Pressure, coercion, demands, and a lack of autonomy.
Everything that kills the mood.
Exactly. When you bring that energy into the bedroom, it destroys vulnerability. It turns sex into a transaction or a competition. Suddenly, there's pressure to perform, anxiety about timing, and an underlying fear of inadequacy or rejection.
It sounds like walking into a performance review instead of a romantic encounter.
That's a great way to put it.
If you are worried your partner is mentally grading you, it is the exact opposite of intimate.
It literally shuts down the very mental pathways required for physical arousal. True intimacy requires the total absence of manipulation.
It requires an environment of complete safety, immense patience, and enthusiastic mutual agreement. You simply cannot force genuine desire.
So all the foundational work we just talked about, swapping the deadly habits of criticizing and blaming for the caring habits of supporting and trusting, that is actually the prerequisite for good sex.
That makes perfect sense. Trust built outside the bedroom by consistently using those 7 caring habits is basically the ultimate aphrodisiac inside the bedroom.
Absolutely. When you feel deeply respected, accepted for exactly who you are, and listened to all day long, your basic needs for love and belonging are met.
And that creates the absolute mental safety required for physical intimacy to truly flourish.
The authors emphasize that while couples should definitely experiment and find what creative physical things work for them, the foundation must always be a total lack of external control.
So when you look at this entire roadmap we've unpacked today, from avoiding that initial cliff of external control to recognizing our underlying basic needs to grabbing the front steering wheel of our own actions, it really strips away the victim mentality.
It completely does.
You aren't at the mercy of a fundamentally broken marriage. You are just sitting in the driver's seat of your own car, and you have the power to steer it differently.
It shifts the focus entirely from the exhausting, impossible task of, you know, how can I fix you, to the empowering reality of how can I manage myself to improve us?
Yes.
You let go of the illusion that you can control your partner, and you reclaim the 100% control you actually have over your own choices.
So we want to leave you with this provocative thought to mull over today as you look at your own relationship. Think about your front wheels, your thoughts, and your actions.
Just the front wheels.
What is one small, positive, unilateral choice you can make with your front wheels today to be a better partner, rather than just sitting in the passenger seat wishing your partner was better?
It could be as simple as swapping a criticism for a moment of listening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the road ahead and the emotional weather of your relationship is ultimately yours to choose.
Well said.
Safe driving out there.
Yeah.